Death Race is for sociopathic killers. You gotta have gravel in your guts. You have to live for the smell of motor oil and high-octane fuel. You gotta love the sound of rubber on asphalt and the taste of blood in your mouth. And when you go to sleep at night, I mean that deep, grim sleep, the sound of bullets whizzing past your head should give you comfort. So, Mr. Strong and Silent, you made it a stuff.
Welcome to Now Playing Podcast's Death Race Retrospective Series.
Sure, it's violent, but that's the way we love it. Violent, violent, violent.
Hosted by Jacob.
Motherfucker's crazy, but cool.
Stuart.
You have the skills I require to keep the legend alive.
And Brock.
Whoever named your car the Bull was only half right.
But be warned, this episode will contain detailed plot spoilers and strong language.
You know what the Dalai Lama said about committees? Oh, that's right. He didn't talk about committees because he wasn't a pussy.
We hope you enjoy the show.
Sounds like the others are stacked against us.
Then do what you do best. Try.
Today we're talking about Death Race 2000, starring David Carradine, Simone Griffith, Sylvester Stallone, Louisa Mortiz, Don Steele, directed by Paul Bartel. This is Brock, co-host of Now Playing.
And Stuart.
And this is the co-host who's loved by dozens, hated by millions, Jacob.
Oh, don't be so hard on yourself.
I can't be more popular than Sylvester Stallone.
I do think at this point I'm one of the haters for Stallone, but maybe this movie can change my mind. It's one of the few things I remembered about it was that he was in it. But I've seen Death Race 2000 once before, a very long time ago on TBS.
This is one of those movies that has been on my watch list for years because as part of my filmography projects, I have one of them is Stallone, and I've been avoiding this one and Lords of Flatbush forever because I don't want to watch these things. But, you know, to balance out the Cate Blanchett and the Daniel Day-Lewis filmographies, you got to have your Stallone and Schwarzeneggers just to keep yourself a little sane.
So this is the first time you have seen this movie?
Oh, yes, first time.
And I have seen this one before as well. In fact, I'm the fan here for this Death Race retrospective. There's just not this cult classic to discuss. There's a Jason Statham film. I've seen that one as well. I'm the fan because I've seen two out of the six films here, and I really like this original one. So, yes, why are we doing Death Race?
Yeah, I'm glad that you bring this up because, yeah, it's hopefully a dead series. By that, I mean one that we're not going to have to come back to next year and the year after as they keep making more and more. Nothing annoys me more than this series, a franchise that won't die after we've really put a button on it. So, we are excited about Furiosa. I mean, I'll speak for myself. I know that, Jacob, you have talked off air about also looking forward to that.
For sure.
I think that's a really great film, Fury Road, and I'm hoping the same will be true for the next one. And we were just looking at automotive movies that we might plug in here. I was like, what about Death Race? I think there's another one. No, there are five other ones. Yeah, this is a huge, long franchise, and it ate up all of our weeks leading up to Furiosa. So I guess it just became a franchise that seems a lot like Mad Max that is right to cover now to quench our thirst as we get ready for that big summer movie.
And for sure, Roger Corman even said, like, there was, yeah, George Miller, they were giving nods to each other. They were bouncing off each other with these car films.
Mm-hmm. Although this predates Mad Max. It should be said, Mad Max didn't get to the States, at least, until 79-80. And this film, though called Death Race 2000, is 1975.
76.
76. Okay, the centennial. Yeah, right around the time America is almost celebrating its 200th year. We celebrate with this snarky bit of satire here. Now, it's worth pointing out, before we talk anything about movies, this is based on a short story from the 50s. Do you guys know this?
Yeah, I read it. I sought it out. I read it. It's so much like this movie and yet so different. It is about a death race, a race across the country where you get points for killing people. But there's no colorful characters. There's no Frankenstein. It stars Willie. You know it's not going to be a gritty, violent story when it's Willie. behind the wheel. And it's more about, yeah, he's confronted with the carnage he's caused and has to deal, like, with that violence that he goes about killing kids and whatnot. And it's more about that internal struggle. And it's not a dark comedy, kind of porno, kind of political action thing that we're going to discuss.
No, like a lot of short stories that are, you know, they're based on a twist, right? You start reading it and you just think it's a cross-country race. It takes a few pages before you realize, wait, they're mowing down people. I noticed he had a cow car with, you know, horns on it, but I didn't know what he'd be doing with those horns. And sure enough, this is, I guess, the story that invented the idea of killing people. I remember when I was learning to drive, driver's ed, it was always a thing about like, oh, there's the old lady for 100 points. It all comes from this?
I'm teaching this to my children when we drive, and my wife, we still make those references.
It was part of the vernacular, and I had no idea that it came from here either. I was going to say something similar. It blew my mind that this is where it came from. And also, I got to be honest, I didn't put it together that they're actually going to kill people while driving. I thought it was death race, but I didn't think it was literally killing people with the cars.
That's part of the fun of discovering this film.
Right, yeah. It's just going to kill them to try and get to the finish line. And no, getting there first gets you something, but getting there with lots of things run over and, yeah, different point values depending on who you are. I agree with you, Jacob. The big difference is in the 1950s, we look upon carnage with horror. We are pre-Vietnam. We don't have a punk sensibility that I associate with independent cinema of the 1970s. In 1950s, the guy is guilt-ridden. This is all about a driver who thinks he's a cool racer until he gets out of his car. He has the biggest pileup, I think, of his career. He kills 30 people in a town and steps out of his car to look at how impressive that was. And he sees the face of a little girl, a victim, you know, someone left behind, and it haunts him. For the rest of the drive, he's unable to run over people.
Yeah, he gets called a butcher.
Yeah, right, a butcher. It has a telltale heart kind of quality. Ted, now every time he thinks he's going to get points, he ends up fighting with his navigator and they have a car accident and he doesn't even finish. He may even be, what, comatose or a vegetable by the end of it. So yes, very, very dramatically stark as compared to what we're here to talk about, the movie's tone.
I mean, this is a Roger Corman production. I had the Shout Factory Blu-ray, which two commentary tracks, a ton of extras, a whole feature by the costume designer and a whole thing by the composer. Like, I heard so many stories, but yeah, a lot of times they're like, are we doing an action film? Are we doing a comedy? Is this political? Is this a porno? Like, no one ever knew what they were really working on here.
Yeah, Roger Corman. Let's just remind folks, we have covered some of his work. Piranha last summer was something that we covered, and Hellraiser, anything New World Pictures. That was like a big telltale sign on video boxes in the 80s. If you saw that orange New World Pictures logo, you knew we were going to get basically an exploitation picture. And Corman is about 5 years into New World Pictures when he makes this one. And I think this is considered, at least by some, as the greatest New World picture, the greatest exploitation flick. I've heard those kinds of superlatives given to this because, yeah, Corman's policy is I throw a little bit of money at you, and if you have talent, you'll make something out of it. And yeah, lots of people are coming out. Jonathan Demme and Scorsese and Ron Howard, all these people are cutting their teeth around this time, learning how to make movies by doing these schlocky little things for Corman.
And I know we're going to be talking Corman. I do want to call out the director, Paul Bartel, who came under that Corman school of filmmaking. He's a director, B-movie actor that I really appreciate when he shows up. In fact, Death Race 2000 was on my short list for underrated films when we were coming up with ideas for the book and what was going to go in there. I went with another Paul Bartel film, though, Eating Raoul, and I could have gone with Private Parts, which is not the Howard Stern biopic, but a real seedy sex thriller. I don't even know what it is from the 70s that he did. But yeah, I like kind of this skeezy, scummy, yet juvenile humor style that he has, and I think comes through in a lot of Corman stuff, but like, if it's got Paul Bartel and Mary Warnoff, I'm happy. You talk about friends of Arnie Stewart in films, like just be characters that he likes. Yeah, give me Paul Bartel and Mary Warnoff. That happened in Chopping Mall. Like, I'm in a good place. This is my kind of thing.
If you don't know who we're talking about, just go on Wikipedia and you'll see his face, instantaneously know who he is. If you've seen, he's like one of those guys, you know his face, you don't know his name. And yes, he's one of those happy accidents when you run across him in a movie. Oh yeah, great.
But yes, as a director, maybe unsung. He only made, I think, a couple of films. He didn't obviously reach the notoriety of a Ron Howard or Jonathan Demme, who win statues as best directors. But yeah, I do think he's subversive and a character actor who, yeah, I agree. Scuzzy's a great word. There's something that always makes me feel a little bit bad.
You got to take a shower after you watch his movies.
Yeah, showering is a necessity after viewing one of his films. Eating Raoul is a gross film. It's a good film, but maybe not to everyone's taste.
And like a typical Corman film, I guess, this is a 17-day shoot. You get in there, you get your shots, you get out, you move on. Like, yeah, no time. They said, start shooting in February, and we have to have 500 reels distributed by April.
And this is the summer of 1975, which is known as really the first popcorn movie summer, the summer of Jaws, and where people, again, their habits are changing. No longer do they want the dark, melancholy works of auteuristic directors. Yeah, that this probably rides the drive-in cinema wave, rides on Jaws' coattails, probably plays afterwards on some. I think it did pretty well as far as exploitation films go.
Oh, for sure, yeah. It was popular. Like, they talked about the biggest expense. You'd think it might be all these cars. No, it was David Carradine, who was coming off of Kung Fu. Like, that had just ended, so he was a known thing, not a huge star. But they were able to get David Carradine as the star for this, who had some name power. I think watching it now, the exciting thing is Stallone. That was one of the things that popped out, because this is right before Rocky. He'd done porn, but his major role was Lords of Flatbush. I don't know if you guys have watched that film. I did watch it just for this, because they said that is why they wanted Stallone. They saw him in that. They're like,
he's a greaser. He and Fonzie. Henry Winkler got his Fonzie cred from this movie.
Yes, Henry Winkler and him are high school seniors in their late 20s, like not looking like high school students at all. But yeah, he plays a greaser. It's going off of that whole, it was the same year as Happy Days. Like, Henry Winkler's playing the same character. I guess he's fine. It's probably better than any Vin Diesel performance. But Corman saw him and he's like, he looks like a good heavy. Like, he'll never be a real actor, but he could always be a good bad guy. So let's get him for that role.
Yeah. Ironically, Carradine and Stallone are both up for Oscars the next year. Not for this movie, but yes, because Stallone is in Rocky. And Carradine did I think it's forgotten now, but he played folk singer Woody Guthrie in Bound for Glory, which was a movie that a lot of people liked at the time. But this is the one you probably remember now. Again, when I think about that one viewing I had as a teenager, late night cable, all I could remember was Stallone's in it in a bit part, like killing people in a car. That's all I could have told you about it.
I think audiences now know David Carradine from Kill Bill, right?
Mm-hmm. And I would imagine Tarantino wanted to cast him in part for roles like this. Kung Fu, certainly. But yes, this is, I think, considered maybe more than Children of the Corn 5, a seminal role for David Carradine.
Well, I'm eager to get our engines moving and I hear the starting pistol. Stuart, how about a plot summary? Let's get onto the race.
Okay. Well, you know, we all remember the year 2000 as being the time of life-threatening reality television being a primetime hit. You know, I conjure up images of half-naked folks forming tribes on an island, but apparently if I had changed the channel, I could watch a 3-day cross-country death race where 5 skilled motorists travel from Manhattan to Los Angeles, mowing down people for points. And these homicidal gearheads include Calamity Jane in a cow car, and Nazi Matilda the Hun, Roman gladiator Nero the Hero, which is an early role for Karate Kid baddie Martin Cove, and of course Stallone as gangster Machine Gun Joe. But no racer is more beloved than Frankenstein, so named because he lost and replaced so many body parts in car crashes over the years. And when we finally get to peek underneath Frankenstein's leather mask, he just looks like an unscarred David Carradine. Frankenstein has more in his mind this year than just winning the race. His newly attached mechanical right hand actually contains a bomb, which he plans to use to blow up the fascist president during a finish line photo op. But in order to get there, Frankenstein must also survive attacks from a group of patriotic rebels who want to stop the race at all costs and plan to assassinate all 5 drivers. Rebels lay landmines, erect road signs that lead drivers over cliffs, and even drop bombs from airplanes. And they do make short work of Nero, Matilda, and Jane. They only want to kidnap the popular Frankenstein. They think they can actually negotiate his release in exchange for the president forever banning the death race. And to make that happen, they sneak one of their own, the rebel Annie, in as Frankenstein's comely new navigator, who is forever sending him down dangerous routes and trying to seduce him. But Frankenstein sees through Annie, he ends up drugging her so he can kill her rebel friends along the route, and ultimately teams up with her on a new plan after he has to use his hand bomb on Stallone. And the film ends with Frankenstein marrying Annie and starting a new government that ends the dictatorship that is plaguing America. Though he can't resist mowing down one more victim, a very annoying broadcast announcer named Junior Bruce, as credits roll. And as they start, what's with this colored pencil stuff? I know you said this movie's cheap, but these credits, I could do this in high school.
Okay, you ready for this? So the costume designer, who this is her first job ever being a costume designer, she'd also done, set design stuff for opening credits on other Corman stuff. So they're like, can you just do this as well? This is kind of what we want. So you get these psychedelic profile of a car. I noticed you could see someone laying down on the ground in the reflection of the hubcap. I thought that was cool, but I don't know. That's part of the charm of this film. It's real kitsch.
This is the first time in one of many that I was thinking of Hanna-Barbera cartoons.
That's generous.
Well, this, you would see something like that in the beginning of one of their cartoons in the early 70s with like the watercolors and this kind of sketchy artist stuff in credit sequences.
I mean, there literally was a Hanna-Barbera cartoon, Wacky Races, where you had the different characters and their cars.
I was going to get to that later, but we can talk about it now. Yes, this movie made me think of Wacky Races when they're introducing all these different people, all the different cars. And if you don't know what we're talking about, this show was in reruns when we were three.
It was old by the time we were young, yeah.
Yeah, but The Dog Who Laughs is Muttley, and Dick Dastardly, and Penelope, whatever her name was. Just Google it. It's very much this way. And it's, I believe, running at the same time as this came out. So therefore, to kind of like mirror images of each other. But yes, Wacky Races came to mind.
Yes, America is in love with cars and car movies and races and what have you. I definitely feel like that was a thing going on in the 70s, specifically as we came up in cartoons, in everything. Just keep in mind, this story was written in the 50s at a time when they were actually making highways. America didn't even have the ability to be traversed by regular roads until the mid-1950s. So yeah, for the next 20 years, we were just obsessed with Route 66 and all of that stuff. It became a part of the American identity that we had these roadways where you could, zip on through. It is about 3 days, I think, driving the speed limit to go from Manhattan to LA. That actually synced up in my head, right? Maybe you break a few speed limits, but I think they get that right.
Yeah, except there, I don't know what happened in the year 2000 to make everything look like Los Angeles. That is one of the things that cracks me up. This is a transcontinental race. It always looks like L.A.
Yeah, I missed that. But my hope is when we get into some of these reboots and things in the future, they have the money to actually go to different areas of America. Because, yes, it very much looks like Southern California from start to finish. But one more thing about, I want to focus on this animation is so poor. It does not look like Saturday morning animation. It does not look like Scooby-Doo or anything we would be consuming. It reminded me of my Animation 1 class in film school. This is, again, if you think about indie cinema, this almost looks unprofessional. No, it looks unprofessional.
It does, but I don't know. To me, that is charm. It looks like something some metalhead would sketch in their notebook in high school. Like, to me, that is cool. That is the right aesthetic for this film.
I thought it worked. And again, I was thinking it was an homage or something. I didn't think of it as bad. There's plenty of bad coming up with graphics and matte paintings and stuff. But here, I was like, okay, it's a choice. Okay, let's go on.
Well, no, I think we're still there. I mean, I think, yes, we jump to a stadium where the race is getting started, and we see a matte painting that is not up to Hollywood standards. And so, again, I ask, I hear Jacob firmly saying, this is what I want. Is this what you want, Brock? Do you want this level of low production?
No, I mean, that matte painting was really bad. Like, really bad. To the point where I think they knew it was bad, so they put it on the screen for like 3 seconds. Like, it was really blink and you miss it bad.
Yeah, they don't use it.
On both commentary tracks, they both had comments about Roger Corman. He's like, you know, you go with what you can afford, and that's what we can afford. Like, he even realizes it looks bad.
Again, to give it a modern perspective, I would expect someone to throw this up on YouTube. If I went to a movie theater and saw this, or even a drive-in and saw this, even in 1975, I would feel like I was being handed something lesser than.
Let me ask you a question, Stuart. So we all know what B-movies are. We understand that the concept of a B-movie, horror movie, I've seen many of them, you've seen many of them. Wouldn't this be something like that then? With these kind of production values in the first 2 minutes of the movie, wouldn't you just expect you're going to get a pulpy B-movie after that?
Well, here's the thing. There is a line, and I think we'll always forever debate what that line is and how much money it is and all that. But there's something that happens where maybe it's even like a curve. There's a certain point where I will not accept this budget and it looks too cheap. And then it can kind of curve back and you're like, I love the fact that the flying saucer is a paper plate on a string.
Yes.
Right. Is it so bad that it's cute? Or is it so bad that I can't watch it? I'm going to get to the happy. But at the start, I would say these first images would have me reaching to turn the channel. And then when I see the cars, I go, oh, wait, those are adorable.
Thank you. When those cars come in, it tells you what this film is. I know Joe Dante came up through the Corman School as well. And like, he loves doing cartoonish stuff. And they said that Dante was probably somewhere on the set here, and John Landis is in this film.
Yeah, I think he's one of the mechanics that gets run over, right?
That Joe runs over, yeah. But yeah, it tells you immediately, oh, this is a cartoon. It's okay to laugh at this, guys. This is not serious.
Not only that, but I actually am impressed looking at these cars, even though they're go-karts. I mean, don't get me wrong. They're not something you could take out into the road, but they look like something I would enjoy as a 12-year-old getting into and going around the tire arena.
These are real VW, like, race cars with the engines in the rear and everything, where, yes, they had these fiberglass bodies fabricated to put on top of them, but, like,
plywood, Jacob, plywood.
Well, yeah, maybe plywood and some of this stuff. It's, yes, I agree. But, you know, they were not street legal. They pointed that out. Like, the stunt drivers would not drive them on real streets. So, like, Corbin's like, I'll get in the car and drive it on a real street. Like, this is the production you're dealing with. But I'm impressed by these cars. Like, they run. They look like real cars, almost.
The movie is going to live or die by whether I like watching these cars on real roads. If this were all blue screen and those matte paintings and people, like, just sitting in the studio pretending to go vroom, 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 this would be intolerable.
Agreed.
Yeah, this whole opening scene at this racetrack, like, they went to a real race, so they had an audience, and they would just film in between the races. So, like, this is a real crowd. Like, obviously, they have their actors to throw on these Frankenstein F shirts or someone to wave a Nazi flag.
Yeah, hopefully they didn't bring their own swastika flags that was provided by the prop shop.
Frankenstein's car reminded me of a little bit like the Batmobile. I also think it'd be a really great Matchbox car, a Hot Wheels car,
because
it really looks like that kind of thing you would get in one of those Hot Wheels sets with tracks that would jump. And so these cars are just wonderful. As soon as the cars rolled up, I thought Wacky Races, and then I thought, okay, I think I'm getting this, what they're going for here, and the announcer with all that energy also sells it. So those three things in a row really gave me the idea of what's going on with these crazy names, with these like roller derby kind of names, and these crazy cars. I understood what the movie was doing.
It should be said, part of why Corman made this movie this year was that they had heard that Rollerball was coming out, which is a roller derby dystopia movie.
It's a very similar storyline, yeah.
Yeah, so they thought that, you know, that's what you do when you're an indie producer, is you go, what are the hits coming? We'll make our ripoffs. And so, as it turns out, I would actually say this movie's better than Rollerball, at least as memory serves.
Yes, it is.
But I do feel like once we see the cars roll out, it's just charming. Again, there's something about it that almost feels like going to an amusement park, a roller coaster, a fun little ride, a kiddie ride almost, and watching adults cram into a kiddie ride and then call themselves Matilda the Hun and Calamity Jane, I get the charm. Almost instantly, I'm able to take that bad taste out of my mouth and go with it.
That's great to hear because I've been having fun since those really bad opening credits. And this is where it really kicks in when you see these cars. And I want to go through all these drivers. But Brock, you mentioned the announcer, Junior Bruce. This was a real DJ. And I do love his energy. Grace Pander, this female one. You know, I always felt like Hunger Games, you just ripped off Battle Royale. Maybe you ripped off this a little too. Like, they always have those flamboyant announcers. And like, that is a lot of the fun of this, is these two announcers doing the gossip back and forth at each stop of the race.
Hunger Games, of course, came to mind, especially after what Stanley Tucci did in that, and Elizabeth Banks, for sure. There's no way that you can't, if you've seen those movies, not see this kind of mirroring. Also, he really sells it. Like, especially, I'm getting ahead a tiny bit, but after that first kill, and I was really shocked that people actually get hit by cars, he really sells that this is what we're doing here. So he really helps set the tone with this incredible buoyancy. And he's a DJ, you say. That makes complete sense to me now.
They do have a third one, too. It's worth pointing out. There's some guy named Harold that's like this mopey...
This is supposed to be the Walter Cronkite of the three.
I was about to say, yeah, it feels like who you'd actually get in a Sunday morning news program or something. Harold. And we're told that this death race has been going on for 20 years, meaning it would have started in 1980, meaning that audiences in 1976 feel like they're only 4 years away from having this be their reality.
Is that a good idea? I always think about that. Why don't you name this something like Death Race 2050 or Death Race 2030 if you're going to be catching up 25 years later to 2000?
Corman just said they put 2000 in it so you knew it was in the future. I don't think they really cared what year it was.
Yeah, 2000's a cool number. It's a round number. And I think you want it to be close enough that people feel like they can see it in their lifetime. If you tell me 3000, well, why should I care? But 2000, I'm going to live to see that, or at least I hope to. The near future dystopia is more appealing than the far away dystopia.
You know, also, Stuart, it could be that 2001 had come out close enough to that. Maybe that's what it is, too.
Of course. A very inspirational concept. A little bit, I don't know, there's some darkness in that as well. But I do feel like that sold a future where we were thriving in our expansion through the universe. This is definitely the inverse of that. That, yes, while maybe those astronauts are going to Jupiter, we're staying home and being run over by celebrities. And let's talk about them. You're right. Part of the charm is getting to know these five participants, starting with the one that I would be. I would actually be in the fur-lined cow car with the horns.
I would definitely be the nav for Calamity Jane because, yes, Mary Warrenoff is my B-movie queen.
Yeah, she's cool. She, like, later, she's actually going to, like, find a matador, and they're going to, like, do the red cape and everything.
The funny thing is, because this actress is from New York, she just never learned to drive, so a lot of stunt driving for it. Like, if that car is moving, it is not her for sure, because she could not drive a car.
But again, the compliment I want to give this movie is, my fear is that this would just look like Bedknobs and Broomsticks or whatever, where, like, people would just be behind a blue screen, and we would project where they're at. And there's a physicality once we get moving. These are real streets. These are real cars. And it's not futzed by special effects.
Yeah, and the camera is going to pull back. It's not like so tight where they could just be getting towed from, you know, up front and they're filming them from behind. You know, a lot of times those cars just in full shots. And I'm not saying, oh, that looks like a stunt driver. Like, it's just, yeah, they got these big garish helmets to cover their heads. And I'm seeing a car move around. And that's what I want.
You very rarely notice the stunt driver or the stuntman throughout the whole movie. I can think of only one off the top of my head right now where I completely saw it. You're absolutely right. And it didn't even occur to me that these people weren't driving these cars because the editing on it was so strong. And I agree. We talked a little bit about this before on other podcasts, like Cannonball Run and Bullet. You can always tell when they're driving on real roads, and here they absolutely are. I wasn't crazy about this actual race stadium. To hear you say that it was an actual place where they do races, I thought it was kind of small for a worldwide race?
The truth of the matter is you wish there were more than five because the fun of the movie is just seeing these characters. The riskiest one is the adorable swastika sweetheart. I guess the producers had already come and gone and had given us permission to laugh about the Third Reich in this way.
We had a television comedy about American prisoners of war locked up by Nazis.
No, Hogan's Heroes did not.
That had not come out yet?
No, it didn't make fun of Nazis the way that, not the same way. There were no swastikas in that.
Yeah, I don't know. I just don't, maybe because I was involved in the punk scene and like Sid Vicious and Johnny Ramone, they would wear swastikas to antagonize people.
Well, yes. They were very rude people. They could get away with subversive humor.
You would never do that now, though, to troll people. I do feel like there was a time you could get away with, like, now you get beat up really bad.
Well, I mean, Family Guy. I mean, there is a long history. Nazis are the go-to if you want to offend people, right? They're offensive then and now. But just thinking about 1975, 1976, to me, this feels like probably their riskiest joke.
But they don't take it too far. Like, she's not running down Jews. Like, they don't actually make any jokes about the history of Nazis, I guess.
She says something about, I'm going to have a final solution for the cowgirl.
Yeah, I mean, there, and she yells Blitzkrieg. Yeah, there's a few things like that.
It's a little bit of wincing.
She's the master race, a woman, like.
Yes, yes. The fact that she's partnered with Herman the German, and he's this nerd, it turns into a dick joke, because he's got this giant rocket on his car. And, of course, the cowgirl is going to make innuendo out of that.
I actually, before the car drove up and I saw the flag in the audience, I thought that they were just lazy. Because, you know, at that point, I was already complaining about the production values. So, like, I saw the Nazi flag in the audience. I'm like, well, that's really strange. Why would they actually have that in a movie? And then she drives up. I'm like, oh, okay, I guess it's all right then. Now I get it. At first glance, I'm like, I actually rewound it. And I'm like, did I see a flag?
Because they already established that the America's flag is this fascist fist with a lightning bolt through it. It looks Nazi-ish, but is not just a flat-out swastika.
And it should also be said, there are no good guys in this. I mean, maybe Frankenstein's a good guy. He still loves violence, but there's no one's behavior that's getting endorsed with this film.
Yeah, they're protagonists, but not heroes.
You mentioned already Nero the hero, who I love the fact that he's actually just named Ray Lonigan, but he's pretending, you know, being fed grapes and wearing the Roman togas and all of this.
Yeah, it was fun to see Martin Cove here show up. Like, I had forgotten he was in this.
He's labeled the loser right away. We know that he's the dead meat red shirt because he's never won these races before. Other people have been competitive, and even his car is kind of stupid with the lion or what have you. And, of course, yeah, Stallone. The concept is he's a Chicago gangster, and so his car has Tommy guns where headlights should be.
This is where that plywood's real obvious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he's got some kind of spearing device as well up the front, a bayonet.
He was shooting into the crowd, wasn't he?
Well, they were wearing F shirts. Those are Frankenstein fans. So we establish here that the rivalry really is he's always number two. He would be the winner last year if Frankenstein would just sit out, if he would retire, stop coming back with new limbs and winning. This would be the number one racer everyone would love. And instead, he's the one everyone loves to hate.
Yeah, they call out that he is the only living survivor to return to the races. So there again, it's telling you expect death, because usually you don't get these survivors besides Frankenstein and Machine Gun Joe.
Yeah, and then Frankenstein, you know, like they, you know, we just covered that series. I'm thinking, you know, that's just an extravagant name. But he is introduced laying down a cadaver on a gurney, being pushed out. They very much want you to think about Boris Karloff and the idea of coming back from the dead here. I love that his helmet has bolts on it.
The costume designer said the direction was just all black leather, and David Carradine, being a vegetarian, didn't want leather. But she said when she finally like got him to go along with an outfit, like, yes, put these zippers all over it. Because she's like, it's got to look like scars if he's Frankenstein. So let's do zippers.
That makes complete sense. But obviously, Darth Vader, it's hard not to see it.
That's what my wife said watching this. This was her first time. She's like, did Star Wars rip this off?
No, no. I think he looks like a lot of sci-fi villains from the 50s and 60s.
He looked like the Super Gimp to me from Pulp Fiction.
I mean, I don't think Darth Vader was, sorry guys, but I don't think he was like some amazing conception no one had ever thought of before. He was very much in the tradition of a sci-fi Flash Gordon villain. That's what he was meant to look. One thing I just want to drill in here. So Frankenstein, his reputation is he's this scarred up, ugly, disgusting thing, but he actually isn't. What are we to make up the fact that when we finally get a look 10 minutes later, when his new navigator takes a peek behind the mask, he doesn't have scars? Is that to say that this is all WWF and that the violence is fake? Or are we to say that the surgeons are just so good they can hide all the scars?
No, he's going to tell us he came up in a training facility. To me, this is, yeah, a government plant. This is a way to bread and circuses for the people and to give them their hero, to manufacture that so you could control it.
No, but my question is, why doesn't he have scars?
Because there's lots of different Frankensteins.
That's what I was going to say. I think it's like the Dread Pirate Roberts. That's what I wrote down. If you guys remember The Princess Bride, Wesley was not the original Dread Pirate Roberts. They all retire after 5 years. And that's why he wears the mask. And that's why you can't see his face, because he's hiding who he actually is so he can come and go as he pleases. And also, when he takes the mask off, he says something like, what do you expect, another pretty face? And he's looking fine, so I thought that was ironic. She was expecting something different. I just thought it was because he looks so good that it was, or looks unscarred, I should say.
Right. I want to focus on that as well. David Carradine is not my idea of a matinee idol.
Right.
He's not a good-looking dude. We're not like, woo, 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 this is such a surprise.
No, my wife was like, put the mask back on. You're still not good-looking.
Exactly. You do better under the mask. And maybe he just didn't want to wear it. Maybe just as an acting choice, we want to be able to see these two get closer without him being impaired by all of this stuff. They don't want to do the makeup. That choice seems strange that he's not actually scarred up. You're saying that this might be his first race? That he's not the one that ran last year?
Maybe.
I got the impression that he was one of many, like Shamu. But they didn't really play up on that very much. If anything, it's like a dangle they throw out there for you to interpret, because he's the one and only Frankenstein throughout the movie, I guess.
At one point, yeah, he'll make a joke about his taste buds getting replaced, and like he's got a smirk, so I think that's just a running gag with him, that everything's been replaced because there is no Frankenstein. It's just whoever they pull out that year for the race to do it.
I think you should have had scars then. I think you should have had that as part of the character. Maybe, again, money. How many days did they have?
17.
Yeah, okay. So you make choices, and that was one that they just couldn't give concession to.
Can you imagine the time for continuity, having to line up scars every day?
Right. But I feel like that throws me off a little bit. It has me asking questions about what's going on with him. And if he's not scarred up and angry, why does he want to kill the president? Now, of course, any president that's holding up his fist and like the capital has been moved to China, like he's actually at his summer home, summer palace in another country.
Yeah, I was having a hard time figuring out this dystopia, because it seems like America has taken over the world, but then we're going to, maybe the French are just always the ones we're going to pick on and make fun of, because that's who they start attacking by the end of this. So I guess there's still other nations, but we rule most of the world.
Yeah, French are always good for a punchline, and so, you know, America cultivates that. And yes, it's a way of look the other way while this guy is clearly doing bad. Obviously, he's exploited what I hear is described as a world crash of 1979. And so he waves the checkered flag, and we get started, and we get some racing.
I got the sense, Stuart, that the world was condensed. So he's in China, but somehow he's able to broadcast there, and then throughout the race, Junior and everybody else seems to, what, fly or teleport to wherever these people are?
This is a Corman film. Just make believe there's like drones with cameras following the cars around televised. That is what I had to do in my head to make sense of this, because it is so sparse. We have no money. Just Junior Bruce is going to know everything going on without any cameras.
So that's the thing. That's why I felt it was condensed. There's something I was missing about everyone's able to watch everything. The Hunger Games have found a way to figure that out. This movie did not explicitly explain how this all works, but I felt like the world got shrunk or something.
Not only that, but it's not called Death Race. That's the name of the movie. But the name of this race is Transcontinental Road Race, which would lead you to believe that there are roads to China. We're going to actually traverse the world, and maybe that was the ambitions one day in the script, and then they realized, no money, 17 days, got to wrap it up at LA.
And it's transcontinental, I guess, technically speaking, that might mean you traverse the one continent, but I always think it's multiple.
Yeah, I mean, yes, that's what it ends up meaning. We have the announcers explicitly lay out that we're going Manhattan to L.A., there'll be breaks in St. Louis and Albuquerque, and then there's all of this point system, and it's not long before we see the first scorer is actually Joe. He's comes up on a road crew, and we find out what his car can do going between the legs of a guy with a jackhammer.
Yeah, some great, really bright red blood that I love to see in an exploitation film is something got cut with that plywood knife.
I thought it was funny that Stallone drew first blood.
I would actually expect, having gone through all those Expendables and all that, Stallone always makes it about him. And I feel like he's playing a character very similar to the ones that he would be famous for. Rocky is the exception. It's the outlier. He's not usually sweet.
It's funny you say that, Stuart, because maybe it's sour grapes on the part of the cast. They didn't become as big as him, but a lot of ego came from him even before he was a star.
No doubt about it. I mean, I think, yeah, Stallone manifested a lot of the success that he's had, and that's how he chose to do it, and it's created the friends and enemies that he has here. I like that he's the villain. I think I would have a harder problem if he were Frankenstein. I like the fact that we have this mysterious David Carradine, who, again, we don't have a whole lot of associations with. I didn't even watch Kung Fu, so he wouldn't have meant anything to me when I first saw this movie. Now, of course, we have Tarantino's Kill Bill. But he doesn't really show up in that until the end anyway, and is maybe even a disappointment, not what you expect. I don't know what his cachet is as an actor, what he brings. He's not going to do Kung Fu.
He's kind of got that 70s cool to me. Like, yeah, he's not going to get real emotional, but he's always in control. Like, I get the vibe.
I got a Peter Fonda vibe from him from Easy Rider. And so maybe that's what they're going for, like his presence that way, right? The swagger.
Okay, fair. Yep. That definitely would have still been a touchstone for everyone going to underground grindhouse movies in 1976, was that 69. Yeah, and really a movie to kick off independent cinema in America. Absolutely.
So here's where, with the point system, the First Blood, we get that bullfight that Stuart mentioned. There's a sign on the road that says smoking is good for your health. The humor is coming on strong here. The euthanasia day at the old folks' home. Like, they have one joke after another, throwing things at the wall to see what will stick. And I have to admit, I was smiling and enjoying the silliness of this first segment.
Yeah, I'm watching this with my wife, her first time seeing it, and I've said this on the podcast before, I thrive on a bad movie. I could go with campiness and cheapness and still have a good time. She's very adverse to that. Like, she will walk out of the room. She hates that. Like, it was so hard to get her to, like, watch enough of The Room to where it finally clicked and she had a good time. So, yeah, she's laughing at this. Like, when they're talking about toddlers being the most points, like, she thought that was funny. So, I think there is something that, if you do have those hangups, the humor is so extreme, it allows you to, yes, this is a cheap, silly film, and I can have fun because they're not taking it seriously. Why should I?
And that's something, again, when going back to that short story that informs this screenplay, that was the inverse. It was actually that young, healthy people were the most points because they could actually get out of the way, whereas, like, babies and old people, well, that's too easy. We won't give you many points. I think you could also run over livestock animals as well. They don't do that here.
Brock, you bring up Euthanasia Day, which, great joke. They wheel all the old people out. Frankenstein's coming up. Oh, he's going to hit these old people in their wheelchairs. No, he's going to go after the doctors, which, one, is funny because it's totally unexpected. And two, it's very informative. It's telling you, oh, there's something different about him. He's not going for the points. He's going for the figures in authority.
I agree. What we're learning on day one, act one, is the idea that this man that's built up as Frankenstein is not who he pretends to be. He is not all scarred up. He is not this monster. I mean, I think his car is, what is it? Is it supposed to be a monster?
It was called the Dragon.
Oh, it's a dragon. Okay, yeah. But I feel like, yeah, it's this green monster, and he's building up this myth that he's this caricature from the cover of a heavy metal album. And in fact, we're seeing that he has a lot of heart. He just doesn't want to convey that to this reporter, this navigator that is really trying to pry into who this guy is. She has her own agenda for kidnapping and seducing Frankenstein. Annie. And we find out pretty quickly that she's tied in with the rebels. We cut away to what looks like a steel mill or something like that. A pacifist or knitting flags and doing pacifist things.
I love, yeah. Why won't the president recognize our passive action? Like, that is probably the best joke in this film.
Yes. And then only Thomasina Paine. I mean, some of these jokes are not funny. I just want to, they're actually funny in how not funny they are. But Thomasina Paine says we need to put Annie in the cockpit and start killing these drivers. And so, yes, they start their plan. On day one, they take out Nero the hero. A man in drag is pretending to be a mother, having a nice picnic with her baby. Go for the mom, go for the baby. Well, the baby is a bomb. straight out of like Acme, Wile E. Coyote pushing a plunger. Boom, their lion car is destroyed trying to drive into this picnic.
And this is not the last time they're going to reference Looney Tunes.
No, there's a giant one coming up. I laughed out loud at that baby because that baby was so obviously not a baby and it's clutching on to dynamite. It was so dumb and stupid. It was just funny as heck.
And Thomasina Paine gets on the radio waves. They're able to cut into this broadcast. She's able to talk a little bit about, basically, I'm not sure that this movie is particularly strong in its politics, but
no,
she wants to restore freedom, right? We live under a fascist and we need to have our personal freedoms again.
And what Corman said, it was post-Vietnam. Like, everyone knew what this meant. When you have a rebel alliance, like, you know who you're rebelling against after Vietnam. Things were very clear. So, yeah, us watching it today, it seems very generic, but to them, it was obvious what they were saying.
But they're also buffoonish, too. Like, the government is buffoonish, and so is this resistance. It's not like they have a moral high ground that they really are able to stick to based on all their actions after this scene.
Yeah, let's take highlighter marker to this. Nixon had just been kicked out of the presidency. I mean, Ford's in office, but his days are numbered. And so, yes, this just looks, it is very popular to hold the president in contempt, to think of him as someone that is self-serving and laughing at our carnage, that is comfortable letting citizens be mowed down so that he can live well. That is a metaphor for how some would characterize the Vietnam War. We do know that Nixon knew it was unwinnable and yet kept us there for years and years afterwards. So yes, perhaps this is working as Vietnam War satire, as well as Looney Tunes. It's walking the line between both and doing a pretty good job. I will say I'm not like falling on the ground. We've had a lot, frankly, of this kind of, you know, I'm thinking about Running Man, Hunger Games, all the things that will come afterwards. We're going back to the infancy, right? This is seeing it as it was first done, maybe not as it was best done.
Definitely not the one with the biggest budget being done.
Right, yes. I mean, it is doing what it can. And again, even though the budget is cheap, and even though there are shots to make you cringe, I am staying with it because I love the cars, and because I love watching the roadside carnage.
Even though they're obviously under-cranking the camera to make these cars look like they're going faster, it's still real cars spinning around, bumping into each other. It's fun to watch.
Yeah,
for sure. For every moment that we're on the road and these cartoonish racers are doing their things and their bits, which I am enjoying very much, I am taken out, Stuart, though, by, like, when they first stop at the first rest stop is, I forget what city it was now.
St. Louis.
St. Louis. His hotel room is a conference room. They even have a conference room push door in the back there.
It was actually a basketball room.
There you go. It's a gymnasium. And they made it look like a hotel room, which was clearly not a hotel room. And things like that pulled me out like instantaneously.
I don't know. It makes it look futuristic because it's just different. It's got this very minimalistic style because they have no money. Like, we'll just have banners hanging from the ceiling. And that's the year 2000.
So let me ask. Do you look forward to seeing a sequel where they're going to be able to do this quote-unquote correctly? Or do you think that this is the best incarnation of the spirit of this snarkiness?
I would be open. You redo this any decade and you could have a lot of fun, the sense of humor. I don't think like this is, it may be the pinnacle of the films we review, but it's not the best that Death Race can be. Like, there's room to improve, but I'm not having a problem with this one.
And I'm enjoying the racing parts very, very much. It's when they stop at the hotel rooms, when they have those scenes with each other in the bedrooms and things like that where I lose complete interest.
Really? It's because I'm having fun like when they cut away and they're giving the widow of the construction worker that Machine Gun Joe hit. Like, there's things, again, it feels Verhoeven, RoboCop to me. And that's on a set too, like, which is so weird. They make it look like it's this victim's home, but that's actually a TV set. And I don't know. I like all the snarkiness as they're getting their nude massages. Stallone, who had been in porn, would not get naked. They're like, we need to see your butt. And he's like, I'm not doing the scene. They're like, put a towel on then. You have to be in the scene. But I like all this banter. You got to have a break from the races. And yeah, to see this pissing match going on between them, it's fun for me.
You do have to have a break from the action. This movie is at its best when it's at its action. So what are they going to do? Yes, we have cute moments like the widow being glad that she's winning an apartment in Acapulco and a new TV set. But then we just also have exploitation movie stuff. Keep in mind, Roger Corman has quotas. Like, things need to be in. A lot of New World Pictures' early hits were just about night nurses. They were exploitation movies about night nurses doing naughty things.
That was Paul Bartel's first film, a naughty night nurse film.
Yes, exactly. And there's like 10 of them before this. So, like, I feel like this is like, we need to just get the actors naked and have a girl fight where they're unclothed, and it just feels exploitative.
And he is unabashedly, he'll admit to all of this. Every car is going to blow up. He's like, yeah, the cars have to blow up. This is a tits and ass movie. Yes, we have to see this. This is how you get people to see my films.
Yeah, and I'm not complaining about these downtime scenes because of the nudity. That's not what I'm complaining about. What I'm complaining about is it's boring. I'm not really learning anything more about these people, except for Frankenstein, that I'm not already learning about them on the road. It's not like they're making big character development scenes here. They're just bickering with each other. It doesn't make any sense to me why it's so long. Yes, pit stop. Just have the scenes with Frankenstein in the hotel room and don't even bother with the masseuse thing. But obviously, as you guys are telling me now, you have to have that for the quota.
If this is not your fetish, if you do not think that this is hot to see these women call each other out while, you know, being naked or whatever, yeah, it's a long slog. It suddenly slows down this speedy little movie to a crawl. And I definitely feel like, I don't know, Carradine is not creating enough mystery for me to care what his agenda is. I think by this point, you could smell the fact that he knows Annie is a plant, that things are going on, and that he has his own agenda. But I don't know, he's just not, this is not character driven. I guess my point is that I feel like I'm here for the amusement park rides. And anytime they're trying to do their build up the myth of Frankenstein, it's not really working for me.
Yeah, to be fair to the film, though, the driver that drives the cow-shaped car is a cowgirl, and the guy who drives the machine gun car is a mafioso. Like, I get what you're saying. I'm going just with the outrageousness. I love the parodies of these newscasters getting the gossip. And yeah, the cat fights, I'm going to win for the master race, women. I don't know. I'm here for the one-liners, I guess.
Some of the one-liners are pretty good. Many of them are not.
There's also a couple of scenes like they have people who, at this pit stop, right, there's that young woman who's wearing the F shirt who wants to introduce herself to Frankenstein. So when she sacrifices herself a little while later, it has more meaning for her and her and the disciples. People who want to get killed by these people, or specific racers they want to get killed by. That sort of scene I was okay with being here instead of them racing.
Well, it explains how he's making any points at all. Because if this guy isn't playing to kill everyone that he sees, then how is he going to win this race? Like, you can't just win by getting to LA first. He has to kill people.
No, you can, because they said that earlier. If you're the first one there, doesn't matter how many, it's like Quidditch. If you catch the golden snitch, doesn't matter how many points you score the rest of the game. It's worth so many points that everything else becomes superfluous.
Yeah, it's worth so many points, but it doesn't guarantee you winning.
I thought it did.
Then why would you kill anybody? Why wouldn't you just race? Don't even stop at the hotel.
Yeah, I thought it was a combination of both, that they took both into account. And what I like about this moment with this fan is that there is a sense of mystery, because when she's down there, he's like, oh, you're here to fuck me. They sent you to have sex with me because you're the fan. And that's what you think of fans, especially in the 70s with groupies. And then later on when it cuts and you see her standing in the road, I don't know, I liked how they had that bit of mystery, this veiled conversation, and then it pays off a few scenes later.
Do you like Frankenstein? He has a lot of disdain for everyone. And I guess that could make him punk rock, right? Middle finger to everything. I only care about myself. He gives a lot of speeches about, I don't race for the president. I don't race for the fans. I think he does care about winning, but he does it because it helps build up his own myth about himself.
I mean, we're going to find out he has the same ends as the resistance, but yeah, he's never going to team up with them. He's going to be killed. Those are some of the few people he will run over.
Yes.
He has an interest in winning the race because he wants to shake hands with the president.
He still wants to overthrow the system, but it's on his own terms.
I want to kill the rebels and the people in power. I want to kill everyone. Nihilism.
Yeah, which is a very punk rock thing. Like, punk rock, a lot of it, especially in the 70s and 80s, a lot of hate for the hippies, because that was seen as the failed movement, the failed resistance. So I totally get a punk rock vibe where, yeah, it's the rebels and the system that are the problem.
Yeah. Maybe if you, and I know you were in a punk band and you are prone to punk rock icons, maybe it makes Frankenstein appealing. I think Carradine's kind of a barrier in this. I find him hard to connect with because he is so nihilistic. I appreciate that he's smart enough to know he's walking into traps with Annie. And, you know, like, he has good one-liners. He can tell people, when the annoying reporter is like, what does it feel like at the moment you run someone down? He's like, meet me on Route 66 tomorrow and I'll tell you.
I mean, it's funny you do say that, because to preview my closing thoughts, it is the nihilism of this film. It is one of the things that does attract me, because ultimately, yeah, I think Frankenstein is nihilistic. He's going to blow up the system. I'm there for it. I don't know what he's going to establish afterwards.
I want to say that I don't dislike Frankenstein. I kind of like that he's centering the movie because everyone else around here is even more wacky and crazy than he is. He has this air about him that clearly the movie is about this guy. But yes, he could have been more flamboyant or different, but I think what he's doing and how he's smart is what gets me intrigued about what he's doing and why. Before we find out, and he's giving us hints that he's on to Annie, and before we find out his big plan later on, there's something about him we don't quite know yet. And again, like I mentioned earlier, he could be one of many Frankensteins. That's never answered. However, it does seem that there is more to him than we'll ever know. And Carradine is doing that to a detriment for you, Stuart. But for me, he's giving enough mystery there that I'm curious about what his end game is even now.
Well, you can't outdo the people around you. I mean, to try and be bigger and funnier than the Nazi and the cowgirl and Stallone is a losing battle. So yes, you're right. He has made us lean into him by telling us almost nothing while everyone else is flying a freak flag. That is what he is doing. But I'm offering the idea that if I'm really going to be invested in a person at some point, and I think they're supposed to happen in these Annie sex scenes, I think we're supposed to see vulnerability and someone that we can admire. And that just doesn't happen for me.
No, it doesn't happen because it seems like she's like a party gift. Like she's part of the swag bag. He gets to nail her.
Well, yeah, she's like this rebel that's working against him. But as soon as she sees him take off those leather pants and he's just got that leather Speedo on, she's down to fuck. Like this is an erotic soft porn film too. And I feel like her, yeah, do not look for deep romantic motivations or characters here. It is about showing skin.
Paul Bortel, scuzzy, again, the director's trademark is coming through, and it's a directive that comes from on high. If we're making a movie this cheap, we have to sell it as a sex film, because just keep in mind, we didn't have the internet. There wasn't as many avenues for people to experience sexual contact visually, so they would oftentimes go to a foreign film or an indie film, you know, air quotes around these, just to get the rocks off, and so that is part of an exploitation flick like this. That's part of why it's here. My point is, for me, it's not kinky enough to be exciting, and it actually kind of slows down the movie. Every time we have nights off, I'm like clock watching.
And I just enjoy the middle finger to Puritan America by having these long, drawn-out sex scenes. To me, it's about, just pissing off authority and not so much about what this actual story is.
But anyway, let's get on to day two. They've got to get to New Mexico. And along the way here, this is really where I think it comes out that Annie is with the rebels.
Yeah, the resistance stuff comes up. And we had that Looney Tunes tunnel gag
that is Wile E. Coyote.
Where the second driver drives off a cliff through in that tunnel, and we're down to three drivers after that. These little bits here is why I'm here. These are what I'm enjoying. It's cartoonish and silly and dumb, but it's playing pretty well. And I'm glad they're balancing out the whole resistance thing with this silliness.
Yeah, I think one of the best gags is, and again, it's telling you a lot about Frankenstein, is at the beginning of the race where he drops his glove, and it's the religious figure that goes to pick it up, and he runs over him to get those points.
Yeah, throughout the movie, they make it pretty clear, I don't have any doubt, that Frankenstein wants to bring down the president. That's not a twist to find out, oh, I have a grenade built into my fake hand, and I'm going to shake his hand and blow him up when I cross the finish line. Again, I think we can spot from his energy. What I don't know is why, other than he's just nihilistic. I don't know what is different about the year 2000 that's different from 1999 or 98 when he lost his jaw and what have you. Is it just that he's been worn down over time by all these races, or are we not to even ask motivating questions?
again, this may be his first race. He talks about coming up in a training facility and who knows what he saw. Like, I don't want a sequel to this film. I want a prequel. I want Death Race, I don't know, 1990.
Okay. But anyway, yes, what basically happens is, well, first, Annie sends Joe off down a wrong path. I don't exactly know why he chooses to believe her, something about his pride. But yeah, we see him take out, I want to call him a fisherman, but he seems to be fishing in like a gulch or like a,
yeah,
like a, not even a stream.
That's what counts for a body of water out here in LA. If it's not the beach, it's a puddle.
A puddle, yes. In the post-apocalypse, this is a raging river, this little trickle. And yeah, we have a scene of him running down a guy in the mud. But then it's her time to suggest a route. And there's supposed to be a fake Frankenstein that's going to keep on driving while they hold Carradine hostage. That's the thought?
That's the plan, yeah.
Okay, but of course, this guy's too cool to be caught, and they're so clownish. Isn't long before they're dead. And yeah, he's, you know, playing tricks like, why don't you drive for a while and let's see if you're going to run down this kid in the road. She can't do it. She can't play the part. She's not willing to keep her double agent credentials. She's not willing to kill.
Yeah, and that's what basically outs her. She said there is a compound filled with, like, senators, like in a re-education cabin situation is how I read it, that he could run over. But that's all a lie. Like, he calls her out. She confesses that's in Japan. We're not going to be able to see that cool scene.
Yeah, that was my least favorite scene in the movie, I think, besides the stopping stuff. This one was, you know, this is what they're trying to do with the plot. This is the plot they're trying to infuse here. I get what they're trying to do to make the movie have a little bit more weight, but I just really do not enjoy any of this stuff. I don't really need this for my movie. The stuff I'm enjoying is not this part of it. This whole spy thing is not really necessary for me.
And I can't help feeling like different actors, someone other than Carradine, something other than this woman, might make me care. I feel like some of this is on the movie itself and not the fact that it's just lightweight and I'm not supposed to get invested. No, I could actually get invested. It's just this is not very good.
I agree. Like Annie, whoever this actress is, I blame her because Carradine's got enough 70s cool that he works for me. But her, yeah, is she supposed to be sexy, defiant? Like I never... She feels like a porn star. I don't get a read on what her personality is. She's there to help move the plot along. And yeah, I could have used, yeah, if it was a better role, like there could have been wittier banter, all that stuff when they're not driving, Brock, you might like.
Maybe. I mean, look, I understand what movie I'm watching. But if they're going to do scenes like this, make it match up or make it balance it out better than what the wackiness is. Because it's also a tone issue. It's getting in the way of me really getting involved and engrossed in the movie. Again, it's a light movie, but you're supposed to have fun, and these interludes are just slowing everything down, and it's ironic considering it's a movie about a race.
Well, here's the thing. Night two, this is his opportunity to turn her in, right? I found out all these things, and then these guys in brown suits come and ask me a bunch of questions. Why did you take that road? Did your navigator suggest it? He could sell her out. Are we really supposed to believe that there's romance budding here? Are we really supposed to believe that he would want to protect her if he's so nihilistic? If he hates the rebellion so much, why not kill her?
Well, I think then him confessing that he is also out to kill the president, I think he decides to save her or spare his life. It's not entirely clear, but I think because they have similar goals, and when it comes, turns out that we find out that his plan is to kill the president too, that kind of explained enough for me why he just didn't kill her.
Yeah, if he outs her at this point, I think the president's on edge. And, like, there's this whole plot. Even though the president gets that there's rebels now, because now is when they come up with the French story to cover it up. But I don't know, if one of the crew members is a rebel, maybe he doesn't get to shake hands, even if he wins.
Yeah, and I do love Frankenstein. When the French thing gets floated, he walks up to, I think it's Myra, who is the navigator of Stallone, and is just like, watch out for those crepe Suzette. There are lines here. I do feel like what keeps me, even in the slow moments, are the zingers, are the fact that there are these corny, instigating little lines. People say funny things, and you get a little chuckle, and you stay committed, even though, as drama, I think it could and should work, and it really isn't working between the love story, if that's what we even want to call it.
Speaking of not working, surprisingly to me, there's a scene right here at the second pit stop where Machine Gun Joe and Frankenstein, Stallone and Carradine, have a fist fight in what looks like a workroom or something. I'm not really sure.
It's the garage. He's actually there to kill Annie because she sent him down that road, the dead-end road. And so he's throttling her. That's the plan. And it's Frankenstein that stops that. And yes, this Batman 1966 fight choreography.
As we discussed earlier, Rocky is the following year. And this choreography is horrible. Stallone, actually, this is the one time I actually saw a stunt double. Whoever was wearing Stallone's wig.
Yeah, it's real obvious.
And the fight choreography is just horrible. And Stallone is completely unconvincing. Again, irony above all ironies. Stallone is not convincing in a fight. It's remarkable.
I wonder how Stallone feels about this movie. I don't ever hear him talking about it. Was he in the bonus features?
He was not. He was there's nothing by Paul Bartel because he was dead, but they even had an old interview by Carradine put in here because he had passed by the time that Blu-ray came out, but nothing about Stallone. And again, just some veiled, backhanded compliments given by the other crew about him on set.
Yeah, I don't get the sense that for Stallone, this was a paycheck that helped him get his baby made, right? He doesn't care about this movie, and so he's not going to give it his all and have a great fight here. Let the fill-in do it, and let the fill-in show their ass, and I'll be in my trailer, right? Writing my script.
They did say he kept trying to rewrite his lines for this.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking of Rocky.
No, he was still working on that too, telling everyone about that script as well.
But let's get to the climax, day three. This is what I'm talking about. So even though Frankenstein knows that he is politically aligned with the rebellion, he is going to drug his navigator and make a point of killing all her friends. What feels like her boyfriend, I don't know why, but there's this Lieutenant Fury, the one that was in drag at the picnic, is now getting in a crop duster and trying to tell him to slow down. I mean, he could just pull over and say, she's alive, let's do this together. This is not about an uprising. This is about a punk rock guy giving the middle finger to everyone, including peaceniks.
Yeah, this is about Roger Corman finding this cool futuristic looking plane and going, hey, can we put that in our movie?
Yeah, and it is. I mean, it's everything that they're able to get a real plane and drop what looks like, I mean, they're not dropping bombs, but they're setting off charges and giving us a really amazing climax. It really is quite propulsive.
So I thought in the first couple of shots that it was a toy plane. I really did. It was a really far shot, and against the mountains, it looked like it was like a remote control thing. And then all of a sudden, you see a closer shot of it, and you see the guy in it, and you actually see them flying over the camera. And I'm like, well, I am impressed that it's a real stinking plane.
I believe this was out in Mojave Desert. I don't know if you ever went out there, Stuart, when you lived out in California, but like, being in Boy Scouts where you go out there all the time, and like, I think this guy was still around. I remember seeing these weird little planes always flying around out there. There is Edwards Air Force Base as well, but like, yeah, this guy is like, yeah, one of those weirdos you'll find in these real rural parts of California.
Yeah, not to mention that also Howard Hughes, like, I knew some aviators that built their own planes and would go out and fly in the desert like this. So they just, it's encouraged this kind of crackpot aviation. And so, yes, that we suddenly just have a plane in this climax is everything. It's all the difference. If it were just another car spin out, that might have gotten boring by this point, but they really have upped the ante.
Yeah, because at one point the rebels pull out a car too to chase him as well, but that quickly crashes, which I'm like, yeah, get rid of that. The plane is so much cooler. I want to focus on the plane.
I wish, because I'm a story guy, they could give me a motivating reason why I should want the Lieutenant Fury to die. That feels weird. That the rebellion I'm supporting, that Frankenstein is supporting, is being put down here. But I guess we still have Thomasina Paine. The grandma is going to live and be a part of the new administration. So we just don't want any of the other dudes going for Annie, I suppose.
After she almost kills her great-great-granddaughter, whatever, they really need to talk and like get their plans in line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll get to the finish line, but first we got to take out Stallone, right?
I was excited to see Oil Slick is finally brought out. If you remember that video game Spy Hunter in the 80s, I love that. You'd get the Oil Slick to throw the guys off your trail.
James Bond does it too, man. James Bond uses Oil Slicks. It's right out of a spy car kind of thing.
Acme. I mean, I think Looney Tunes. But yes, yes. He's got a cool car that has all these traps. And yeah, it seems to work for a little while. Frankenstein's not unstoppable, but he ultimately, I don't know what, he's got the hand.
He gives up his hand grenade.
Yes. The thing that he needs to destroy the president, he really, it's Annie makes the choice for him, uses it here.
And for listeners who did not watch this but are listening to us for some reason, by hand grenade, we mean a literal hand with a grenade built into it that he was going to shake hands with the president with.
And she unscrews it like it's a bottle cap and throws it into the machine gun car. Again, that's the stuff I like. I want to stress that is where I find charm and inventiveness and imagination in what these technicians are doing. Those kinds of moments are a lot of fun. It should also be stated, my cowgirl, Calamity Jane, was killed by the Rebellion before they mounted their attack on Frankenstein. They kind of jumped in her car and she was able to fight them off, but she ends up backing up against a landmine.
What was really cool about that scene, that is the only time in this movie that had any sort of tension, because she was backing and forth. She could hit the mine. Oh my God. Oh, she missed it. Oh, she could hit it. Oh, she missed it. It was finally anticipation and tension, the only time in the movie.
And they said this was influenced by horror. Like, that's what they went to build that tension. And like, oh, she almost hits it. Like, and I'm cheering for her. I'm like, yes, get away. And then I thought she might actually do it. And then she has to back up one more time.
She actually became sort of a likable character. She had actually thanked everyone the morning before they got in the cars of just being, you know, good racers.
Yeah, she realized, like, the rebels are coming after them, and hey, let's, like, make nice and team up against them.
Yeah, I regret losing her, happy to see Stallone blown up, and feel like it's the ending is a foregone conclusion. But you're right, I did not anticipate the switcheroo. That Carradine is going to get naked, give all his black leather to Annie. What has she got in her hand?
Just a knife? A shiv?
Yeah, it looked like a scalpel, maybe. She has a medical kit, so she probably pulled something sharp out of that. Is just going to give a big old hug to the president and then knife him. And then her own great-grandma, thank God she's a bad shot, but she's there in the audience to assassinate her. Should they have killed her? I feel like Annie should have died. I feel like if you're selling nihilism, but of course they're also selling porno, and you got to leave the woman alive for someone to screw at the end. But I just feel like it would be more fun to have everyone dead at the end except Frankenstein.
And that was the original ending. Frankenstein runs into the president. Cut to credits. It's over. And it was right before they started shooting, they decided to add the wedding scene onto there. And I do like that jump cut. Like, you see Frankenstein climbing out of the wreckage, and then it cuts, and he's like all of a sudden married and the president now. And
yeah, it's a nice little pat ending. And they fell in love, Annie and Frankenstein, after all. And grandma's there, and they kill Junior, right? They kill Junior at the end, finally.
And extend this movie, this very short movie that is just barely 80 minutes. I give it a few extra minutes there.
Yeah, they have this voiceover, which I really like. It's like violence, and it's the whole history of violence since caveman days. And I guess this is where it's trying to maybe make its point. But the editor's like, yeah, we had to do that because then we could say the film is still going to get to feature length.
Mm-hmm. It's padded, for sure. I feel like the ending is Frankenstein kills them all. That his girl gets shot by her own grandma, and then he mows down grandma, mows down the president, mows down the announcer, and mows down his fans, and rides off into the sunset. To me, that is the ultimate middle finger that this movie is striving for. But yes, by having it this way, we can have our cake, our wedding cake, and eat it too. We can have a happy ending, and we can kill that annoying announcer.
Yeah, you say happy ending. To me, it almost feels like, let's throw out all the politics, because now this is commentary. Like, I feel Frankenstein's the president because he's the most violent person in America now that he's killed the president. So, of course, we love him, and of course, we're going to make him the president. And who cares what his policies are? But it's violence, violence, violence that we care about.
Anyone that's a rebellion against happiness, I don't know. The language is such that it really feels rather cute. Again, the death race is abolished. There will be no more nihilism allowed here. This is a utopia that he's ushering in. And the whole idea of being married, in and of itself, a conventional thing. Like, it just feels like they're going for something less subversive than they were for the previous 70 minutes.
So, Jacob, Stewart, do you recommend Death Race 2000? Jacob.
No, we did a whole dystopian series a while back, and I was thinking about dystopian modern ones, dystopian films, and do we really have, like, just silly satires? Like, Triangle of Sadness, great satire film, but it's like, that's actually artsy and had a budget and money and a real director. And, like, this kind of stuff, there's a line by the Resistance, the age of obedience is over. And I do feel like in the 70s and 80s, you got films like Animal House, Repo Man, Blues Brothers, where it's just, let's just do general chaos. And that was its politics. Like, they didn't really have politics. It was just like middle fingers to authority. And I always appreciate that. But probably a shock to no one, when I was a teenager and very political, probably took it a little too serious. Like, if I'm listening to punk music, I want the political ones that have a clear message. Crass, Dead Kennedys, bands like that. It took me a long time to get into like the Ramones, because I'm like, yeah, it's fast, but it's about, you know, now I want to sniff some glue. That's not what I'm about. That's not my politics. And then I kind of came around on that. I'm like, you know what? There's something about just writing fun party tunes for the apocalypse. Yes, it's very nihilistic. We don't like anything that's going on. We don't have any solutions, but maybe we could just blow it up with some silly songs. And that is something I came to embrace later on in life. Just, yeah, maybe there doesn't need to be a message. Maybe it's just like, let's be disobedient. Let's make a trashy film that has some great one-liners, some great car chases. If you're into TNA, there's some great TNA in this. Yeah, it's a dirty, cheap exploitation film, but yeah, it probably is the best Roger Corman production that I've seen. Like, Surf Nazis Must Die, better title, not a very good film. It does not live up to that awesome title. So for a Corman film, like, this is high budget. This is high production. Everything works. If you want a raucous, non-PC time, check out Death Race 2000. Strong recommend.
Stuart.
Yeah, you got to be willing to like retro, because I agree with you. There's nothing really like this now, unless it's on YouTube or you know, what I imagine this level of unprofessionalism is what people, social media, they promote. But if you're paying for entertainment, you don't have a movie this raw and lightweight, I don't think. And so, yeah, going back to the past, my reference really is watching Death Race 2000 is like playing Atari 2600. It's this crude game that scores obvious points. You know, like, I don't think politically it's particularly challenging. You have to be charmed by the low-rent graphics, the simplistic winning strategy to it, the repetitiousness of it, and you can have some fun. I really think that it helps. It's everything that they made some cool cars. You absolutely need this racing footage, these actors playing these colorful archetypes in these cars are just so much fun. Carradine, Stallone even, you know, like, they're interesting because they were already stars or would become stars in the future, but they're just part of the menagerie here. And I don't, again, my favorite character is the cowgirl. I also think it helps that this movie is very short. It knows what it can do, and it knows what it can't do. And once it's done everything that it can, and a little bit extra, again, I didn't really like...
It got an airplane.
Yeah. The Annie scenes and all the love story, they try for something there that doesn't work. But once they get really delivering an awesome climax, they're out of here. And yes, if you need more substance, go to Running Man, go to Hunger Games, go to Battle Royale. There are other places to see this more. Maybe we will find that out as we go into the sequels and reboots that are ahead in this franchise. I don't know that this will be the best one, but I feel like it is some kind of blueprint for the whole entire genre that I find charming. I'm going to give it a mild recommend. There are other movies that do laps around Corman's sideshow, but you can still have a lot of fun with just these basic elements.
So you're playing the optimistic Arnie role, thinking they're going to get better.
I hope they do.
Four direct-to-video films are going to get better.
I hope they do, yes.
Well, yeah, it's hard not to have fun with some of this. There are some very entertaining things. I think having Sylvester Stallone here in a very early role is so much fun for us who have seen Stallone do so many other movies. I think it's a bit of a mess of a movie. It really is. It's two or three different movies mushed together. There are funny one-liners. The cars, I love the cars. Anytime they're actually running the race, I'm having a good time. I grew up in the early days of cable with the movie channel and HBO watching the Cannonball Run. The first one especially, over and over again. We watch pieces and parts of it. We very rarely sit down from the beginning to end. It was always on there. So when I was older, I sat down and watched both Cannonball Run 1 and 2, and they're not very good movies. As an adult, you can see all the flaws there. However, when they're driving and they have all those bits, it's entertaining to watch that first one, especially. It's an entertaining, turn your brain off, some fun characters doing some silly things. And here, when they're driving, it's like that. And they have this, I guess they have a social commentary, that I wasn't completely buying into or understanding why I needed that aspect of it besides of the, this is the setup so we can kill people in cars and be exploitative, blah, blah, blah. It seemed like a ramshackle thing. But it's very challenging for me to not recommend this movie because it's simple, it's short, it succeeds more than it fails, and I think Stewart has the perfect word for it. It's charming. It's a quaint little thing that if you sit down for 80 minutes, I'd say about 60 of it is pretty entertaining. Whether or not it's good or not, it's entertaining or entertaining enough that you'll be, you know, wanting to see how it ends. So it's the weakest of recommends from me. It's not a great movie, folks, but there is some fun to be had.
At no point do I have the illusion that it's doing this the best. I'm always thinking about how it could be improved and how it has been done better and bigger and louder, which is, again, part of my optimism for how remaking it or coming back to it could be a fun thing.
Come on, Stuart. This is very impressive. If it was like a high school production, this would be amazing.
It is. I went to film school. I watched people try to pull off things that they could not do. And there is still a level of, again, it's a recommend. Not like I'm giving a sliding scale of calling a bad movie pretty good. It is an entertaining movie, but I do feel like the room to improve is large. That there is a whole world out there that more money, more talent can fill in. Roger Corman got us going. He got the engine running, but other people can take us to higher plateaus.
Well, Jacob said it perfectly. What's coming up for us are direct-to-video sequels, right?
No. Death Race was in the movie theaters.
Okay, so we have something to look forward to.
Someone thought that was worth millions and millions of dollars.
Well, Statham is probably the draw, right?
Right.
And I've seen that one, and my memory was, I liked it. Now, that was 2008. I've changed since then, so who knows?
Yeah, we talked Statham last year on the show. We love us some Statham.
I always love Statham, yeah.
Yeah, he brings it, man. He's fun to watch. So we will see. But my point of why I'm bringing this up is very rarely have we seen a direct-to-video sequel and said, oh, this one was better than the last one. There have been exceptions. One of the Chucky movies is actually pretty damn good. So it's possible that our sequels will be something special. And we're going to find out next week when we discuss the direct sequel to this movie, Death Race 2050.
Yeah, from the year 2017, not 2008. You got to wait on Statham. We're not getting there yet. We're going out of order.
I want to drive that home. What we are covering next is what has been described to me as a direct sequel to this, whereas Statham's is a rethink, reboot, and its own universe that has a continuity that will not be connected with Roger Corman. But Roger Corman is behind the camera next week for Death Race 2050.
All right, so Stuart, before we get to the starting line for next week's podcast in this series, what else do we have coming up?
Yeah, it's time for the Platinum Donors. You guys have been very patient. You've watched us go through Home Alones. You've watched us go through Beverly Hills Cops and all those 80s buddies cop movies. Now we're getting to some 90s and 2000s buddy movies, not all cop movies, from a very specific writer of that genre. Shane Black is known as the creator of Lethal Weapon. And he's got four movies we picked out. We're starting with a movie that feels a lot like Lethal Weapon to me, Last Boy Scout. It's Bruce Willis and Damon Wayans kicking off the 90s as if it was still 1989.
I haven't seen that one since VHS. I got it from Blockbuster Video.
Exactly. And that will be interesting, right? That's what my experience has been going through all those 80s buddy cop things is like many times not good movies, but maybe good representations of a certain spirit, kind of like this movie, of just like a time and place, a time capsule, and you can enjoy a thing for being a product of its time. We will see. Join us Friday. All you got to do to become a Platinum Donor is post it on our website, nowplayingpodcast.com. We'll see you there.
All right, great. So thank you, Jacob and Stuart, for having this conversation today. So we'll be back here next week for Death Race 2050. Damn, I love this game.
Well, America, there you have it.
Thank you for listening to this Now Playing Podcast movie review.
My pleasure.
Support from listeners like you keeps Now Playing Podcast on the air.
What'd you expect? Another pretty face?
You can donate directly by tapping the support button at nowplayingpodcast.com.
It's time for action.
You can also compare notes with us on Letterboxd. Go to letterboxd.com/nowplaying to see what our hosts are watching when we're not recording podcasts. And follow Now Playing on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and our YouTube channel.
Why can't they see me as I see myself? A kind, gentle soul imprisoned by abs of steel.
Now Playing Podcast is produced by Arnie Carvalho.
He moves them, inspires them.
Associate produced by Jason Latham.
You're very good at what you do, and I'm very good at what I do.
Now Playing is edited by Heath, Santiago, and Arnie.
Took the best, made it better.
Now Playing credits read by Brock.
I swear by St. Dwayne the Rock Johnson, I will slap that sinful tramp!
The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the views of Venganza Media Incorporated.
If you want to drive again next year, Mr. Viterbo, you'll keep those opinions to yourself.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with, and this podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created the film analyzed herein.
Don't talk to the other drivers. Frank never did part of the mystique. Let the mask do the work.
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review, and no infringement is intended.
You got that right.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2024, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Good night, Mr. Frankenstein.